Thanks, Ada. Just making sure you earn your keep there. Is that Bible reading? Get your flicking between things. And what a great introduction to a sermon with the breath. That's really good. So, what does the word God mean? We Christians have one idea of what the word God means. Hindus, for example, have quite another. And as did the ancient Greeks and Romans. This sermon is part of a series about the Old Testament names of God that the Hebrews use. And a lot of these names tell us a bit about the character of God, but the two names I've chosen tell us more about what the word God actually means, but only if we take them in their proper biblical context. The meaning can change quite a lot depending on the context. So we'll begin with a bit of biblical context. John 4:24 says that God is spirit. This is what Jesus tells the Samaritan woman. She was asking him if God should be worshipped in Samaria or over in Jerusalem. Now, when she asked about worship, she wasn't asking where she could sing songs to God or pray to God. She's asking about where God's presence dwelt. The Samaritan woman was asking about a physical place where heaven and earth overlapped, where God was thought to dwell. Her question was actually an intelligent question for that time, before the resurrection. The physical location actually did matter at that time, and Jesus wasted no time in telling her that that place was Jerusalem, because salvation was of the Jews. At that time, God wanted people to understand that heaven and earth overlapped only in one place, Israel, and especially at the temple. But Jesus also told her that a time was coming when God would be worshipped in spirit and in truth. A time was coming when the location would not matter anymore. Heaven and earth would overlap wherever God's people were. This would be more realistic worship because God is not bounded by physical location. God is spirit. Spirit, as Tim mentioned, comes from a Greek word that means air or breath. Air and breath are invisible, life-giving, and also not bounded by physical location. So ancient people used this word for things that went beyond the physical realm. We live in the physical realm, but there is also a spiritual heavenly realm. So where is this spiritual realm? Oh, thanks very much. Well, in the beginning, the overlap between heaven and earth was found in Eden. Eden was a sacred area where humanity could readily interact with the spiritual realm. Adam and Eve could walk with God and maybe had a divine authority as residents of the heavenly realm. But as we know, humanity was cast out of Eden. Humanity can no longer enter the heavenly realm. The spiritual realm would become mostly hidden from us. Later, after the Exodus, Israel would become the place where heaven and earth overlapped. And today, the church is that place. But this overlap is not quite the same as it was in Eden. It's not that the spiritual realm is far away. It's just that we can't perceive it anymore. For example, take the incident with the servant of Elisha. In 2 Kings 6, we see a glimpse of the heavenly realm. An evil king had sent an army to capture the prophet Elisha. Elisha's servant was panicking with fear. So Elisha asked God to open the servant's eyes to the heavenly realm. And the servant saw a heavenly army stationed there ready to defend them. The spiritual realm was there all along. It's just that the servant couldn't perceive it. Something similar happens during the Transfiguration, when the disciples see Jesus with Moses and Elijah. One minute the disciples can see Moses and Elijah, the next minute they can't. The Bible teaches that the spiritual realm is all around us, but somehow still beyond our perception. So now we come to biblical context. When we consider how the Bible talks about this spiritual realm, we should remember that the Bible wasn't written in our language or with our worldview. It was mostly written in the ancient Near East, using their languages and their understanding of the cosmos. They hadn't been to space yet. They didn't know the Earth was round or the stars are flaming balls of gas. From their perspective, the physical realm was basically the ground they stood on. That's what they thought of as the Earth. They thought of the spiritual realm as anything that could live its normal life beyond the sky, above what they thought of as the physical realm. This is why they sometimes lumped the sky in with the heavens. It was all a realm beyond the Earth. So they used it as a way of talking about the transcendent spiritual realm. Any being that was normally found in the spiritual realm was given the same label, Elohim. The Bible refers to a range of beings as Elohim, from what we might call angels, to what we might call demons, to stars, to even the spirit of a deceased human, the prophet Samuel. These are all called Elohim, because they're all normally found in the heavenly realm. This is important to know, because it prevents us from misunderstanding the times in the Bible when beings other than Yahweh are called Elohim. The Bible is not trying to say that these beings are all on the same level as Yahweh. These other Elohim are all created beings, not creators. There's only one creator who created all spiritual and physical things, God himself. By far, the most common use of the word Elohim in the Bible is for God himself. God is seen as the spirit being and superior to all other spirit beings. But because God himself is not the only spirit being, English Bibles sometimes translate these other Elohim as gods, or with a small g, or sons of gods, because they also normally dwell in the spiritual realm. It's not so much a way of describing what they are, but more where they are, where they normally exist. It's a way of saying that we normally don't see them in our earthly realm. There's also a connection to authority, because the heavenly realm is where ultimate authority comes from, but I'll come back to that. Either way, you can see that when the Bible uses the word Elohim, or a small g god, we have to think carefully about which kind of God is being referred to. So I'll spend a bit of this sermon talking about small g gods to distinguish them from the capital G God. Both are technically Elohim, able to exist beyond our physical realm, but they're completely different kinds of beings. The Bible writers are anxious to stress that the one true God is completely above and superior to all these other spiritual beings. So the Bible writers sometimes use the phrase El Elyon, God Most High, to distinguish Yahweh, the Creator, from all other spiritual beings. Take Psalm 97. All who worship images are put to shame. Those who boast in idols, worship Him, all gods. For you, O Lord, are the Most High over all the earth. You are exalted far above all gods. This verse talks about how these small g gods should be worshipping Yahweh, the Most High God. People had been making physical idols or images to represent their small g gods that they worshipped. But verse 9 stresses that these small g gods are nothing compared to the Most High. They are all Elohim, but Yahweh is unique. In the ancient Near East, people made statues called images. And they had ceremonies to try and get Elohim to come and fill the statues. But we're supposed to be the image of God, and the only Elohim is supposed to fill us is Yahweh himself. Yahweh alone is uncreated. He alone is the reality behind all creation. The rest of us, earthly or heavenly, human or angelic, owe our existence to him. That's why he alone is God Most High. Before God made the physical realm, he created the spiritual beings that we tend to call angels. But since they are Elohim, spirits, sometimes the Bible calls them gods or sons of God. They were made to serve the one true God, the way a son might serve his father. They're sometimes called the divine council or the divine assembly. Angels are created to serve God as representatives, the way an ambassador might represent a king. In biblical language, they're supposed to image God in the heavenly realm. Since they represent or image God, they have a kind of divine authority. The heavenly realm was seen as the place where true authority lies. So, beings sent to us from heaven were seen to have a divine authority. Even humans with authority were seen to have received that authority from heaven. How does this authority work? Well, in the divine assembly, the Most High is the boss, but he lets the angels get involved in his rule. God makes the decrees, but sometimes he lets certain angels decide how those decrees should be carried out. Take the death of Ahab. In 1 Kings 22, God decrees that the evil king Ahab should die by being enticed into a certain battle. But God leaves it to one of the angels to decide how he should be enticed. God decrees a basic idea, and the angels get to decide the details. God doesn't need angels any more than he needs us, but he likes relationship, so he includes them. This is a great honor for them, a high calling. Their connection to God gives them a certain dignity, but also a certain accountability. Sadly, some of these angels, these Elohim, have failed their high calling. Whoops. Some of these angels seem to have rebelled against the Most High. Although we humans can become evil all by ourselves, some angels seem to have tried to accelerate our corruption, turning humanity away from God. Take the serpent in the Garden of Eden. That was probably an Elohim. A close examination of the Hebrew suggests that this wasn't really a serpent, but a fallen angel. This angel rebelled against the Most High, so God made him lick the dust of the earth, a way of saying that he was now banished to the place of the dead, the dirt where you bury people, under the earth. He wanted to be Most High, so God made him the Most Low. Later, we have hints that there were other rebellious angels or other gods or sons of gods who, instead of watching over the nations, decided to corrupt the nations to false gods. These rebellious Elohim are the principalities and powers that Paul talks about in Ephesians. A sizable chunk of the Bible is about Yahweh winning humanity back from these small g gods. Many missionaries today take this idea very seriously and will pray against these gods before entering a new area. Others might suggest that the Bible's just using metaphor and symbolism when it talks about these rebellious gods, perhaps talking about a human idea of a god or a human ruler who claimed to be a god. Still others are somewhere in the middle, which is probably where I am with it. I don't think it's wise to get too fascinated by angels and demons. But the Bible does teach that there is a spiritual reality out there, and we don't want to be ignorant about it. I feel the same way about the pagan gods. We don't want to get too fascinated by them, or certainly not fear them, but we don't want to be ignorant about them either. Because of this, I'm going to mention some of them today because it can be useful to understand just how different these pagan gods really were. If modern Westerners were more aware of these differences, perhaps they wouldn't take the true God for granted. Take the pagan nations to the north of Israel. Initially, they may have had the right idea. Take Melchizedek, for example, was called the priest of the Most High. But even if they started out okay, their ideas became corrupted. The Most High they started to believe in was very different to the God of the Bible in terms of his character. Their version did not have the same respect for justice and mercy that Yahweh did. Some worshipped Baal as the Most High. Baal worship led to exploitation and human sacrifice. Some of the pagans further afield from Israel, so the Greeks or the Romans, also had stories of gods, but with the top god being similar in kind to the lower gods. They saw the cosmos as being uncreated and eternal, and believed that their gods sort of just emerged from the chaos of the cosmos. Even their top god was seen to be inside the circle, part of this cosmos, this universe. But it brings us back to that question of what the word God actually means. Atheists sometimes fall into the trap of thinking of the biblical God as if he was similar in kind to the created to created things. When they ask questions like, who made God? They're unconsciously thinking of the biblical God as if he was similar in kind to the rest of this universe, this cosmos. Now, there are a lot of good atheists and good pagans, but there are circumstances where these worldviews can lead to the same outcome, survival of the fittest. Pagan cultures are often about the strong dominating the weak, even among their gods. Some cultures even had stories of various gods actually having battles for the top god, top job. This cosmos ends up getting divided between the strong and the weak, rather than the righteous and the wicked. In that environment, compassion can be seen as a weakness rather than a virtue. These pagan gods had little compassion for humanity. The ancient Greeks thought of humanity as perhaps an unimportant side project of one of the gods, created to be slaves for the gods. We humans could try to appease them with ritual, but these pagan gods didn't have much interest in us, and certainly not for the poor and oppressed. If they did take an interest in humans, it was mainly in the strong and powerful humans, especially rulers. Conveniently, for these strong rulers at least, the strong were believed to have a divine right to dominate and enslave the weak. That was seen as the way of nature. Some pagan rulers, like the pharaohs and Caesars, even started calling themselves sons of God. It became a way of saying, I'm so great that I'm sort of like the gods. And in a way, they weren't completely wrong. They had authority. Authority came from heaven. So, because they had been given authority, these rulers in the Bible are sometimes called Elohim. But their idea of heaven was filled with pagan gods. And just like the pagan gods, these rulers treated the rest of humanity as their personal slaves. So although the pagans and the Bible writers used similar language, they both spoke of Elohim and El Elyon, gods and God Most High, there were radical differences in what they meant by that. The Bible writers believed that the Most High God was completely above and beyond all other spiritual beings. Yahweh didn't emerge from the cosmos, but created it, and is therefore the only being worthy of worship. He is the ultimate reality behind everything. The idea of another Elohim being a contender in a battle against the Most High is laughable. And far from seeing humanity as uninteresting or slaves for the gods, the Bible says the Most High was super interested in humans, strong and weak alike. The Most High valued all. Therefore, virtues like justice and compassion actually matter. Humans weren't created at the bottom of the hierarchy to be slaves to those above us. but were given a special dignity of bearing God's image in the physical realm. The Most High God created our physical universe specifically to allow life, specifically life like us. Astonishingly, we lowly earth creatures, tiny and short-lived as we are central to the meaning of the cosmos itself. We were made in God's image. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Just like the angels, God lets us humans share in his rule. In the same way the angels image God in heaven, so we humans image God on earth. We have been given a certain authority. Authority comes from heaven. So the Bible sometimes speaks as humans as being Elohim, especially humans with authority. Take Moses. When Moses was sent to Pharaoh, God says, "You will be as God to Pharaoh. You will be as Elohim to Pharaoh." In other words, you will represent me to Pharaoh, or image me to Pharaoh. Another example is Psalm 82. This is the psalm that Jesus quotes to prove that the scripture sometimes refers to humans as Elohim. It's actually a psalm of judgment against unjust human rulers. But God, in this psalm, is rebuking human rulers for failing to live up to their high calling as small g gods. I, God, said you, human rulers, are gods. You are all sons of the Most High. But you will die like mere men. You will fall like every other ruler. It's as if God is saying to these corrupt human rulers that, yeah, you have been given authority from heaven. And yes, you are, in that sense, gods. But you've failed to use that authority for justice, so you're going to face judgment like all other men. God gave us an authority, but it came with a responsibility. God, in this psalm, is disappointed with these human rulers for failing to live up to the honor of being called gods or sons of the Most High. We humans have been given a high calling. This gives us humans a certain accountability, but also a certain dignity. That dignity is why our modern idea of human dignity can be traced back to the Bible. It's why the idea of human rights came from the Judeo-Christian tradition rather than, say, the worship of Baal or Zeus. Human rights now form the basis of the legal systems of many nations on earth. We just take human dignity for granted these days, but it hasn't always been like that. If human rights are the fruit, then Judeo-Christianity is the fruit tree. Sadly, many claim to value the fruit while at the same time attacking the tree. They think these values just sprang from the purity of their own hearts. But the reality is it's taken thousands of years to cultivate these values into our culture. Without the gospel, we modern people would be no better than the ancient pagans. Now, I'm not suggesting that all non-Christian worldviews are 100% bad. And I'm certainly not suggesting that all non-Christian people are 100% bad. Think of the Good Samaritan, the Roman centurion, Naaman. There's plenty of examples where people in the Bible where people with pagan backgrounds are actually better people than those with the right theology. But what I am saying is that we should be grateful for what the true God has given us. There is a real danger in abandoning the true God. It will eventually degrade our God-given human dignity. God has given humanity both a dignity and a purpose, which brings us to my fourth and last point about Jesus. Humanity was so highly regarded by Yahweh that Yahweh planned to become human. The main way the gospel writers refer to Jesus' divinity is with the title Son of Man. In most contexts, Son of Man just means human. but it could refer to one very special human. The prophet Daniel spoke of a human figure that would somehow be godlike and sit at God's right hand in heaven. So the idea that the Christ might be one with the Father was consistent even with Old Testament scripture. Jesus wasn't just any son of man, any human. He was the Son of Man specifically referred to in Daniel, who sits at the right hand of God himself. No angel was given that honour. The idea that God would become human, let alone allow himself to be crucified for humanity, was madness to the pagans. But from the beginning, God has had a special interest in humans. The Most High wasn't too proud to become human. Turns out the Most High has a servant heart. Jesus demonstrated what being God Most High meant by washing the disciples' feet, taking the role of a servant. The great human rulers of great empires came and went, but this God remains. The pharaohs and Caesars who tried to climb to the top of the status ladder, they're no longer worshipped, but the God who washes our feet remains. The rebellious angels who lusted after an equal status with the Most High are now the most loved. But the God who humbled himself to death, even death on a cross, remains. This is the God who gave us human rights. This is the God who changed history for the better. This is the God who is worthy to receive our worship. This is the God who is now exalted to the highest place at the right hand of the Father, once more reunited in the Godhead, so that at the name of this God, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is God Most High, to the glory of God the Father.